So as the oldest of the daughters and the first to challenge her father, Seitel is the model for all the others. Hers is the mildest of the confrontations, and therefore the easiest for Tevye to accommodate. It seems harmless, but all the features and implications of rebellion are already present here.
I wonder if you can just explain to us, by setting the scene, why the betrothal is such an important moment in the life of this family. It's hard, I think, for us as modern readers to understand its full significance.
Well, we're dealing here with the work of a father that has many daughters. And from the perspective of that time, the most important task of the father was to see to the marriage of his daughter. Obviously, this was a familial obligation, but it was also a national obligation, because it is through women that the faith and that the people is going to be propagated or not. That is to say, Jewish continuity is through the mother, through the matrilineal line. And so the idea of finding the proper match for your daughter, securing a dowry for her so that you can get a match at the highest level that you can possibly get for her, having in mind all the values connected with that, was considered to be the first obligation of the father of daughters. Now, this isn't so unusual. I mean, many cultures look at it the same way, but this was certainly still the obligation of a traditional father like Tevye. So that's first and foremost why it is so important to him. And once the daughters come to be of marriageable age, obviously the matchmaker was going to come, as they do at the beginning of this third story, to offer a match. And then it was going to be up to the father to consider it and to see whether it was appropriate or not. Now, what happens in these stories, of which this is the first, is that each of these matches is looked at from the matchmaker and the father's point of view, and I would say from the parents' point of view, because also from Golda, the mother's point of view, it's looked at from their generation's point of view in one way. And then the children are now making themselves heard and felt. At the end of the last discussion, we were suggesting that in Tevye's telling, the down-to-earth matters of the plot are pretty much inseparable from the Jewish story and from the covenantal story that's ultimately about the Jews' relation to God, or what amounts to the same thing, the survival of the Jews in history. And so we might keep this in mind, this simultaneity in mind, when in this next story we switch to an apparently new set of issues, Tevye's daughters. And this is the part of the Tevye stories that I think has become the much more familiar because of the way in which it figures in all the dramatizations of these works. So this is how Tevye introduces this episode to his steady listener, Mr. Shalom Aleichem. Say what you will about today's children, Pani Shalom Aleichem, Bonim Gidalti V'Romamti. First you have them, then you break your back for them. Make every sacrifice. Put yourself through the mill, and for what? So that maybe you think if you've managed to get ahead a bit in life, you can help them get somewhere too? I wouldn't dream of having Brodsky for my son-in-law. Brodsky being today, one might say, or Rothschild, Trump, for my son-in-law. But that doesn't mean that I have to settle for just anyone, because I'm not such a nobody myself. And since I don't come, as my wife likes to put it, from a long line of fishmongers, I had hoped for some luck with my daughters. How was that? Well, in the first place, because God gave them good looks. And a pretty face, as the saying goes, is half a dowry. And secondly, because even if with God's help I'm no longer the Tevye I once was, someone like me still rates a good match even in your hoopets, don't you think? The trouble is that the same merciful God who's always practicing his miracles on me, first seeing how quick he can raise a man up and then how fast he can dump him down, has let me know in no uncertain terms, Tevye, stop being so ridiculous as to think that you can run the world. Well, wait till you hear how the world runs itself without me. And who naturally does it run right over first? Why? Your schlamazel of a Tevye, of course. So this is the spoken voice, and I think it is worthwhile to read some of this out loud, just to realize how much of it, and especially in the conversations that Tevye conveys, how much of it is meant to be a performance, a really something alive, something that brings the voice alive and the personality alive. So Tevye here plunges right into the issue of raising children. You invest everything in these children, and then what happens? Nothing works out as you planned. I have nourished and brought up children. That's the quotation. Now, Tevye quotes only the first part of the sentence, but again, he and Shalom Aleichem and the readers would have known this famous opening verse of the prophet Isaiah, "For the Lord has spoken, I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner and the ass its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people does not consider." So Tevye has daughters, and God has the Jewish people, and both these relationships between father and children are governed by the same realization that neither authority can enforce allegiance or ensure compliance. Tevye can get his horse to obey him, more or less. He has trouble even with his horse, but he will never whip his children into obedience. And so the bond is always going to be tenuous and negotiable, torn between various kinds of love and duty. And since membership in the Jewish people is transmitted through the women, at stake in the fate of Tevye's daughters is the destiny of Israel, the Jewish people. So this doesn't take anything away from the comedy. Tevye's comedy, though, is the comedy of Jewish endurance. So the Yiddish saying is, I think, what defined how many daughters, because in Yiddish the expression is, sieben Töchter ist nicht kein Gelächter. Seven daughters is no laughing matter. And there's the rhyme between the daughters and the laughter. So it was the father's responsibility to provide his daughters with dowries large enough to attract suitable husbands. And thus making a living was always associated with this obligation, which was taken very seriously. Jews had special charities to provide dowries for indigent brides, and the profession of matchmaking was as stratified as the society itself, with brokers at different levels trying to connect families that were appropriately matched. So as soon as Tevye makes enough to feed his family, he moves to the next level of concern. And in the 4 years since the opening story, the oldest daughter has reached marriageable age. Tevye is slow to recognize how his children have grown, but ready or not, here come the surprises. So Tevye is just recovering from the loss of his investment with Menachem Mendel when his wife Golda tells him that he should go to town to Anatevka because the butcher, Lazar Wolf, has been asking to see him. If a butcher asks to meet with a dairy farmer, the man may assume that he is interested in buying a calf or a cow. Jewish life divides so strictly between dairy and meat that this dichotomy is bound to enter Jewish fiction as part of the natural, the innate symbolism or demarcation. So butchers in Yiddish and Hebrew literature are often dark characters, and Tevye, who deals in dairy goods, is the archetype of the milky personality. In fact, in Yiddish, Tevye der Milchiker actually translates into Tevye of the milky personality. And I think that before Shalom Aleichem's use of it in this way, Milchiker was not used commonly as the term for dairyman at all. So when Sholem Aleichem used it as Tevye der Milchiker, the milkman, makes sense to say the milkman or the dairyman in English. This was really as much about the personality as about the occupation. So it's Tevye the softy, and Tevye doesn't want to hand over his animal to be slaughtered, but neither can he resist an economic opportunity. So he approaches the rendezvous with the butcher with very mixed feelings. But since Golda has already included the information that this message from the butcher has been delivered through Zeitel, who is sent to town on Thursdays to buy meat for the Sabbath now that the family can afford it, readers suspect that there may be more going on here than the purchase of a cow. And the ensuing comedy of miscommunication satisfies all our expectations. This kind of muddle is the universal stuff of comedy. You and I can talk business, says Laser Wolf, when the two men meet face to face. You see, lately I've had my eye on... I know you have, I said. But it won't do you any good. It's out of the question, Laser Wolf, simply out of the question. But why? He says, giving me an astonished look. Because there's no hurry, I say. She's still young. The river won't catch fire if we wait a little longer. So it's funny how long these two men can go on talking at cross purposes about the sale of a cow and acquiring a wife, all the while underscoring the coarse nature of this mistake. So you could hardly find a better example of the commodification of women. Right? This is to treat women as this negotiable material. And telling the story like this at his own expense, Tevye realizes that he was wrong to have treated marriage as a business arrangement, and by the end, he stands corrected. In fact, by the end, he helps to correct his error. Zeitel, his daughter, teaches him that she's not part of the commercial transaction, whether intended for her own good or for the sake of her family. The misunderstanding between the butcher and the dairyman is the result of an outdated system that is being or has already been overthrown.
Well, this, Professor Weiss, brings together two points that I think are interesting, because in the first two lectures, you helped us focus on Sholem Aleichem's portrayal of what I'll call class conflict in the story. Mm-hmm. And here, introducing a second arena, a second axis of the conflict in society, the conflict of generations.
Right.
Here, the class conflict and the generational conflict are mixed up. In the question of Tevye and Matul.
They absolutely are mixed up. And yet here, really, I think that this is one of two such episodes, because the next one is going to be pretty much on the same subject in a much more dire way. But it also has to do with rich and poor and with a change that was taking place. A change not just in the idea of status, but in the importance of work, of labor. This had to do with positivism. This had to do with a new emphasis on the great importance of labor, of productivity in society. And this was also a concept that was entering Jewish life and challenging the idea of learnedness, of religious life as being of a higher level than actually productivity. We could call it part of the process of secularization, but it had to do with a shift in values. So the theme of this and the next four stories is the challenge to parental authority, a staple of human affairs that gets magnified during times of real transition and real change. The term modern in the story's title, in Yiddish it is heintike kinder, today's children, meaning modern children, it leaves us no doubt that the times were a-changing. This story was written in 1899 at the portentous turn of the century. The European novel was generating, and it would continue to generate, many confrontations between parents and children. One could even say that this was the main theme and subject of European literature at the end of the 19th century. Ivan Turgenev, one of Shalom Aleichem's favorite authors, wrote Fathers and Sons. Samuel Butler wrote The Way of All Flesh, Balzac's Père Goriot, later D.H. Lawrence's Sons and Lovers, Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks. These are only some of the books written on what later came to be known as the generation gap. And it was also the burning subject of Hebrew literature of the Enlightenment. Now here, let me just say that Alan Mintz, a wonderful Hebrew scholar who unfortunately recently passed away much too young, wrote a book, which I commend to you, called Banished from Their Father's Table, Loss of Faith and Hebrew Autobiography. And this title is drawn from a passage in the Babylonian Talmud that reads, "Woe to the father who has banished his children from his table, and woe to the children who have been banished from their father's table." Now, Mintz applies this to the young Jewish intellectuals and writers of the Haskalah era, of the Jewish Enlightenment period, which is the 1870s through the turn of the century. And they are these people who lost faith in Jewish religious teachings, and they developed a new mode of writing, a new mode of autobiographical writing, to describe their struggle to liberate themselves from the bonds of their tradition. Now, since Jewish religion was inseparable from the Jewish way of life, including family and community, this break was extremely traumatic. And Mintz shows how writers treated this trauma, the trauma of their generation, in autobiographical fiction. Now, of the writers that Mintz names here and the works that he names, Lillian Bloom's The Sins of Youth, Mordechai Feuerberg's Whither, La'an, Mika Yosef Berdichevsky's A Raven Flies, and Yosef Chaim Brenner's In Winter, Shalom Aleichem certainly knew the first, and the other three are almost exactly contemporaneous with this story of Zeitl. So when we compare these works with the stories of Tevye, we see how exceptional he was, in some sense, how daring he was, although others said how undaring he was, how old-fashioned he was in treating these from the parents' point of view. Right? But these stories are written. This is the unique feature of these stories, that these are stories about the generation gap, which are written by a member of the older generation, rather than from the more usual perspective of the rebellious youth. The stories of Tevye's daughters, beginning with Zeitl, are all about the protests against the way Tevye exerts his authority and what that authority represents. Had it been told from Zeitl's point of view, the story would have taken us in the direction of change, which, of course, we understand, and we will talk about what that direction is. But narrated by Tevye, the story is about how much of the change he is able and willing to accept, and what, if anything, he is still able to keep intact. So Tevye the narrator, let's just say, is the figure of authority. This was at least formally a patriarchal society. Tevye is not, as we've seen, an absentee father like Menachem Mendel, but one who assumes responsibility for his wife and family. And his interaction with Menachem Mendel contrasts his practical and dependable side compared with the other man's detachment from reality. His interaction with the butcher, though, shows the other side of this. This time, he is the more delicate one, and Lazer Wolf is the coarse and insensitive and much more pragmatic one of the two. Tevye values refinement, and though his reach exceeds his grasp, his aspiration to be a man of learning is at the heart of his material ambitions. He does not like the butcher, because this man, among other things, is involved in killing animals. And although this is an accepted part of Jewish religious practice, Tevye does not approve of it. Nonetheless, as someone involved in ritual slaughter and as a well-to-do resident of the town, Lazer Wolf enjoys a higher status than Tevye, and, ambivalent or not, Once Tevye understands the butcher's proposal, he is tempted by the material security that it offers. I don't know where else to do it, so let me just pause here for a minute on the question of animals in the writing of Sholem Aleichem and in this work. So one important object of satire in the literature of the Haskalah of the Jewish Enlightenment was the treatment of animals, the indifference of Jewish society to nature generally and to the treatment of animals in particular. Mendel HaMoecher Svorim, the Yiddish writer whom Sholem Aleichem called the Zayde, the grandfather of modern Yiddish literature, wrote a really stunning story called The Calf, comparing the life of a Jewish boy to that of a calf, both being raised in order to bring them to slaughter. And sure enough, when the boy learns that his calf has been slaughtered, he who has been sent off to the yeshiva to be turned into a proper Jew goes mad, right? So Sholem Aleichem also wrote several stories with animals as the main character or the stand-in for a disadvantaged creature. Although the comic miscommunication between the two men about daughter and cow points up the commercial treatment of women, it also includes, I think, criticism of the treatment of calves and cows as items to be bought and sold for killing and consumption. In this work, where, as Irving Howe put it, Tevye talks to his horse the way he talks to God, Tevye humanizes his equine partner. The horse is his conveyance, but also his companion. Tevye sometimes takes out his anger on the horse, but he also cares for it the way he cares for his daughters. To humanize, again, to humanize is not in this sense to romanticize. And Tevye is no saint, but very much in the kind of romantic tradition. He sees himself as part of nature. And as I was saying, in many ways, this work is a corrective. And one of the ways we see that working is in this sensitivity of Tevye's, to the degree that he can allow himself to be sensitive to the animals with whom he is in contact. So here is Tevye's voice again. It was evening, and the sun was going down. From far away came the croaking of the frogs. My fettered horse stood nibbling grass. The cows back from pasture were waiting with their feed bags to be milked. All around me, the greenery gave off a smell like paradise. And as I sat there thinking about things, it struck me how cleverly the good Lord had made his world so that every creature, from man to beast, could earn its keep. Only there were no free lunches. You want to eat, Mrs. Cow? Then let's have some milk, help a poor Jew support his wife and kids. You want some grass, Mr. Horse? Then please be so kind as to trot over to Boyberick with those milk cans. And you too, Mr. Man, you want some bread for your belly? Work. So this childlike style of Tevye's thinking is something that we find just as much in the letters that Sholem Aleichem wrote to his family and to his friends. And it is one of the very many ways in which the author resembles his creation. So now back to the negotiation between Tevye and the butcher. So you see that Laser Wolf's proposal would have been a terrific boon for Tevye. He would not have had to provide a dowry. His child would have had financial security, and he and Golda would benefit directly from their association with the butcher. After the arrangement is made, Tevye's prayer changes a little, and it reflects his gratitude. This time, he recites the prayers of Hallel, the Jews' marvelous praise of the Almighty. God does not always live up to his promise, but this time he has come through. I love the Lord because he has heard my voice and my prayers. Of course I love him. Wouldn't you, if he had cupped a hand to his ear just to listen to your prayers? The sorrows of death encompassed me and the pains of hell got hold of me. There I was, a poor wretch surrounded by worries. One day a cow dies on me out of the blue. The next it's my luck to run into a schlamazel of a cousin, a Miss Menachem Mendel of Yehupitz, and so on. And so prayer is the way Tevye is what, as I've said, psychoanalysis is for others. The free association with here God as the healer sitting in the big chair. And here for a change, Tevye comes down on the side of satisfaction. That is, until Tzeitel throws herself on his mercy and begs him to let her out of the engagement. When he sees her misery, he does not hesitate. If you say no, it's no. He will not sacrifice his daughter. But this is the start, not the end, of the challenge to his authority. She not only refuses the match that he arranges, but she arranges a match of her own, governed by different criteria. So as the oldest of the daughters and the first to challenge her father, Tzeitel is the model for all the others. Hers is the mildest of the confrontations, and therefore the easiest for Tevye to accommodate. It seems harmless, but all the features and implications of rebellion are already present here. Tzeitel and Motel come at him with several blows rolled into one. First, they arrange their betrothal without him, and they inform him after the fact. "Are you crazy?" he shouts at Motel. "Since when can you be the matchmaker, the father-in-law, and the groom rolled into one? I suppose you want to be the rabbi and the band leader too? I never in all my life heard of a young man making matches for himself." Now, traditional matches, of course, take into account the collective of which the individual forms a part. Modern marriages are governed by individual choices of men and women. From Romeo and Juliet to My Big Fat Greek Wedding, this has been a staple of romantic comedy or tragedy, depending on the outcome and the perspective. In this case, though the traditional father is the one telling the story, it figures as comedy, and it has a satisfying ending because the father accepts the new conditions and the values that stand behind them. Tevye accepts Tzeitel's marriage and becomes an accomplice by reconciling his wife to the marriage as well. By cleverly attributing the choice of the bridegroom to Golda's grandmother Tzeitel, he suggests that this marriage is actually sanctioned by the generations back in time. And he may also be convincing himself that this is all sanctioned within a traditional as well as a more modern framework. And reluctantly and with due reservation, Tevye adapts to the idea that the young may make their own decisions about marriage despite its essential bearing on the life of the people. So I would say it's such a sweet story, and it seems so easily resolved, so summertime still, so much in that spirit, that we would never, if we didn't know what came afterwards, we would never suspect what this could lead to. Well, love, why not? Isn't this wonderful that people just fall in love, right? And so they do. And here, it is all lovely. Now, the second part of this challenge to Tevye's authority involves Motel's profession. This won't say a lot to us, but it's very important still in this story. In the Jewish hierarchy of Yichus, Y-I-K-H-E-S in English transcription, social ranking, the scholar stood highest, and the person who works with his hands stood at the bottom. Motel is a poor man from the lowest rung on the Jewish social ladder. Then there was a hierarchy even among tailors. There were those who designed and made the entire garment, and there were patch tailors, like Motel, who took their trade out into the countryside, visiting the peasantry and repairing their clothes. At the time that he comes courting, Muddle does not yet have a sewing machine. Muddle is one of the latter. He is a patch tailor. Tevye dreamt of a match that would advance him in the social hierarchy. Yet he does not need much convincing on this score to accept as his son-in-law the tailor. And he says, "When I saw my Muddle standing there with his head bowed contritely, looking so serious and sincere, I couldn't help thinking, maybe I had the wrong attitude. What was I being so snooty about? And who did I think I was? The great grandson of Reb Tzatzkele of Pripetchik?" Making this up, I mean, really. So Tevye is ultimately seen to be proud of earning his living by the sweat of his brow. He sees the value in honest, productive labor. In nature itself, as he sees it, God has arranged the world, as we said, so that every creature from man to beast has to earn its keep. So how can he dismiss a hard-working tailor who pleads his own case and shares his own values and observes the same way of life that he observes? So the miscommunication with Muddle, which is almost parallel to the miscommunication with the butcher, is, however, is much sweeter than the exchange with Laser Wolf. Tevye thinks that he is proposing a match for Zeitl, whereas Muddle is, of course, in tailor's jargon, proposing a match for himself. Muddle is honest, industrious, humble, polite, and like Tevye, he is also trying to achieve financial independence. This is the idyllic phase of modernity, where the children still want more or less the same thing as their parents, but they just want to do it on their own. That Tevye actually prefers Muddle to Laser Wolf tells us how much he also shares his values of usefulness and hard work as against the values of the suppliers of kosher meat. So it seems like a very small point here. Shall the father choose the bridegroom, or shall the bridegroom offer himself, and shall the children do it on their own? It's here still played out in a rather sunny setting, because for all that, the differences in this case between the parents' generation and the generation of the young is not that great. It's not that substantive, because in choosing their own match, in many ways, the children are choosing what is still in many ways aligned with the parents' way of life. When Zeitl and Muddle come to their father for his blessing, for the father's blessing, they really want that. They really feel it's such a relief to get it. They want a wedding. They want to be married according to the Jewish faith. They don't want anything different. They just wanted to be able to choose it themselves. So that is one way in which it is not that much of a confrontation. And then there are other ways in which these are challenges. It's slight, but to that generation it would not have been that slight. There was a Jewish hierarchy, a Jewish social hierarchy, and in the Jewish social hierarchy, learning stood very high, and wealth, but the combination of wealth and learning, also always wealth tempered by learning, and then the person who worked with his hands was at the bottom. Muddle, the tailor, is not just a tailor, but he is the lowest level of tailoring. He's a patch tailor. In other words, he's just a repair tailor. So he would not only be poor, but in the idea of lineage, of yichus, as it's known in Jewish terms, status, he would be very low. So in many of these ways, Tevye does not feel well served by a young man who cannot provide well for his daughter, and who's certainly not going to bring any status to him. Nevertheless, as I say, this challenge, too, is fairly mild because, as Muddle says to Tevye, "Wait a minute, you are also a person who has been working very hard, working, doing physical labor in addition to everything else, so why do you feel that this is not honorable?" Muddle, oddly enough, in justifying himself, he also justifies Tevye's way of life to him and says, what's wrong with the way in which you earned your living? Isn't it honorable? And of course, Tevye agrees that it was indeed honorable and says of himself, who am I to put on airs after all? So isn't that interesting that in several ways, Mottl and Zeitl's challenge actually is a validation of Tevye's way of life?
The criteria of the parents is perpetuation, for the most part.
Right.
And the criteria of the children is something else.
Well, the individual begins to make himself and herself felt very strongly, and that is really at the center of what we call the modern way of looking at life. The individual says, you know, I have rights, and among my rights is the right to happiness. And happiness means love. It means finding my own bashereter. Mm-hmm. I mean, who's destined for me.
Yes, exercising one's own freedom to control one's life, to choose,
yes. one's own freedom to choose. And so this is what Mottl and Zeitl want for themselves. The parents, on the other hand, have to think of perpetuation of their family, of their lineage, and perpetuation of the Jewish family, which is completely interdependent here. The collectivity, the community is really the family, and the family is the individual. And the individual is expected to know that he is part of something larger than himself. And so this is really a true clash, a true conflict, and what makes this story so delicate and so interesting in relation to what comes after is that here everything seems resolvable. Everything can end happily.
Because as you say, Mottl and Zeitl want what their parents want for the most part. They love what their parents love for the most part.
Right.
They want to establish a Jewish family
that
furthers the national perpetuation, that perpetuates the nation. But because they've introduced the autonomy and freedom dimension to it, it's a very subtle entrance of what grows into a bigger conflict. Maybe we'll see some more of that in the next lecture.
We will see some more of that in the next lecture, and we will also be reminded, as we should be reminded all along, that these are episodes being written in real time, so that the difference between 1899, when this story was written, and Hoddle 5 years later is immense. So I think we've noted how much of the comedy in this episode turns on miscommunications when people speaking ostensibly the same language are not talking about the same thing at all. In this story, the misunderstandings are soon straightened out. The youngsters win the approval of their parents and go on to live very similar lives. Tevye is disappointed not to realize his dream of gaining greater status and security. But when all is said and done, Zeitl's marriage, the subject of the story, preserves the status quo. The pattern of communication reflects the ups and downs of the plot. Whereas the negotiations between Tevye and each of his suitors are long and convoluted, his conversation with Zeitl is remarkably direct. His daughter does not want to be brought to the altar like the first fruits to the, you know, of an offering. And she does not want to be a sacrifice. She throws herself on her father's mercy, and look what happens. Tevye sees Zeitl crying and asks, what is it? She says, darling papa, I don't care if I have to live on bread and water. Just have pity on me and my youth. She was crying so hard that she couldn't say any more, God help us. For by now, I guessed what it was. This father understands his daughter almost instantly when she speaks so straightforwardly, and he yields to her entreaty. No doubt he's disappointed, and this involves him in embarrassment, acute embarrassment. I must say that at that time, divorce was sanctioned. Divorce, actually, we learned from historians now, was really quite common. And you'd be surprised how common it was among East European Jewry. However, breaking an engagement was considered worse, because this seemed to reflect on something that you found out about the ride beforehand. And so that was really considered to be a great taboo. And here is Tevye, for all that, breaking this engagement contract that he has made with the butcher, simply because he must, because he feels that he has to give in to his daughter. And he probably understands her so instantly also because he himself did not like this prospective son-in-law. And he may be relieved, ultimately, that his daughter declines the offer that he should never have accepted. In a sense, her refusal to be betrothed to someone as coarse as Laser Wolf speaks for Tevye's genuine values more than his willingness to be bought off by wealth. This suggests that the young men and women who are choosing their own partners might arrive at even a more wholesome decision than the decisions made for them by their parents. And then, as I say, Tevye himself resorts to this deliberate kind of miscommunication to fabricate a story that will make it easier for Golde to accept what he has already made his peace with. He could simply have told her what was happening, and he could have said, "That's that." But he wants her to think that the marriage is ordained, bashert, right? That it is preordained, that it is sanctioned, and not simply necessary. And so he invokes this authority of Bobitzaitl. This is more than a white lie. It is an invented rationale. And it brings to mind what Sholem Aleichem said about his writing, that he wanted to comfort the Jews in their distress, that he was trying to alleviate pain through comic catharsis and through telling stories. Tevye amuses himself through storytelling and thereby appeases his wife and makes things easier for his daughter and his son-in-law. Do you see what this is? Tevye is doing something parallel to what Sholem Aleichem is doing in his writing. He is doing the same thing as Sholem Aleichem is doing in writing the Tevye stories, writing fiction to show how and why we have to adapt to the new realities. And in his comic way, this is what Tevye is doing here by inventing this fiction to make his wife make her peace with these new realities. So there is, of course, one other motif involved in Seitel being the oldest of Tevye's daughters, and that is the emancipation of women, as well as working men and Jews. Seitel hesitates, but then she speaks up and she's listened to. Tevye repeatedly uses this quotation, Kerachemov albonim, literally, as God is merciful to his sons, to refer equally to his daughters, whether because he is joking, or because he is mistaken, or because he understands it to mean children. In any case, the daughters, one by one, come into their own, signifying one of the greatest changes of modern times, the increasing insistence of women on determining their own lives. Tevye was never one of those bullying men, bullying fathers, who expected women to do their bidding, but he does take for granted that men are expected to be stronger and to be the authorities and to be more knowledgeable. And in this chapter, the young women begin to challenge that assumption. And this is something, of course, that they will keep doing ever more forcefully. Because these stories were written in real time, they reflect the contemporary atmosphere as well as the problems. The stories of the daughters introduce the most critical changes to Jewish national cohesion. But in 1899, the date of this story, Sholem Aleichem felt that the gap between generations was really not that much wider than the Jewish gap between rich and poor, as he has let us see it in the previous stories. Generational conflict and the uprising of women and the breakdown of communication were urgent, but they were still far from being at crisis proportion. At this early stage, at least in his stories, Seitel and Mottl have made their own arrangements independently of Tevye, but they come to him for his approval. They want a traditional marriage, and they establish a Jewish family. all too traditional, as it turns out, since they are unable to escape the poverty of the declining Jewish town. When they finally speak to Tevye, they speak to him directly. The obstacles to their marriage are removed by the father who created the obstacles. Tevye often invokes God, the merciful father, as the model for his actions. And here he seems to feel as secure in God's sympathy as his children are in his. In this first challenge to parental authority, Tevye is able to fully appreciate his child's wishes. He can yield to her request. He can help her carry out her desires. And the young couple gains its freedom, the freedom it seeks, without breaking any bonds. So just to summarize this, you see what has been accomplished here. The children win their right to self-determination. The working man gets respect for the value of his labor, and it upsets the traditional hierarchy of values and substitutes a new, down-to-earth, pragmatic code of values. And the young woman asserts her right to make independent decisions. So these are three very big gains. And in granting them, I think it's fair to say Tevye feels that he gains more than he loses. In granting them this, he gains more than he loses, if I'm not mistaken here. And so this story was written in 1899. It, too, was published in Der Yid, in this very important Zionist weekly publication that was meant to be the cultural underpinnings of an independent modern Jewish people. And when we will come to the next episode, the story of Hodl, which was written 5 years later, you really see that it's been a lifetime in the history of Russian Jewry, in the history of Russia in those 5 years.
What should the reader and the viewer have in mind as we turn to the next, to Hodl?
One of it is the idea of individual choice and the right to make individual choices. The second is really the idea of the challenge of productive labor as opposed to all kinds of religious activities and intellectual activities which are not considered to be part of the productive labor, a transvaluation of values, if you will, of this kind. And the third one is also the women's right, the right of the woman to choose on her own behalf. And this is the introduction of all those three themes.